Welcome, and thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, where the most gruesome, the most horrific, the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, they are discussed, they are examined, and they are profiled. Now for season 10, I have to add a legal disclaimer. 95% of this material that I have attained, it's obtained from online public record and or articles that have been obtained from news media sources like the Baltimore Sun, the Daily Record, it could be Fox 45 News, etc., etc. In some cases, the actual participants were contacted for their input or version of their story. And in some cases, the participants responded to my request, and their input was included in the case. It was included in their profile or whatever episode that we are discussing. If the participants did not respond to the request for interviews, then the information that I have obtained was obtained online for the episode, or it was obtained from public record. Now, with all of that out the way, for this season, season 10, in my opinion, becoming a police officer, a correctional officer, or any career in law enforcement, it really is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. So for this season, season 10, the focus is on anybody, any high profile, any law enforcement official, any type of law enforcement related type of homicides. This can include murders that were committed on any law enforcement official, or any murders committed by any law enforcement official. And when I say law enforcement officials, for this season, I am referring to police officers, I'm referring to state troopers, I'm referring to correctional officers. And for this particular episode, the law enforcement homicide that I am going to profile is the brutal murder of Roxbury Correctional Institute officer Jeffrey Allen Roten. And because this is a podcast that focuses on the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, to be fair, this podcast also has a huge, huge goal in assisting with any unsolved homicide that needs a second look or needs special attention because the case is now considered a cold case. And this episode's unsolved homicide is the shooting murder of Xavier John Arthur Green. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this to y'all before or not, but way back in the day, many, many years ago, I used to be a CO, a correctional officer at the then Maryland Penitentiary, where they used to put anybody that was sentenced to life. Like if you were a lifer, you had 25 years of life or whatever, they was going to put your ass in the Maryland pen. And that's where my job was, to guard these inmates. And you know me, I mean, y'all know me, I worked hard to get up in there. Back then, they wasn't just hiring any type of CO. I mean, you had to pass a test, you had to do this, you had to do that. And even then, I love the challenge. I mean, I wasn't even barely 21 yet. I remember I had just turned 21. I had just made the legal age where you could be hired as a correctional officer. And I remember I aced that test. I thought that I was going to be okay with working there, which was, you know, basically babysitting grown ass men. You know, being a correctional officer for me, especially in my family, that was like a lifelong dream for me. It was like the opportunity to help inmates, especially, you know, people who had or was locked up. You know, for some reason, that was like a calling for me. I don't know why. I mean, anyway, eventually I did quit that position because not only did my father get murdered around about the same time that I started working there, and I just got real distracted. And when I say everything in my life changed after my father was murdered, everything changed. My focus changed. My life changed. And one of the things that had a big impact and one of the things that changed was my job and my focus. Nothing felt the same. And I didn't stay there long enough to really feel out the job or to really see if that was something that was meant for me to do. I do remember being put on a tier though, literally my first day. I kid y'all not. It was my first day working at the Maryland Penn. I didn't even have a uniform on. I remember being put on a tier with keys, dressed in my regular street clothes because I didn't even have a uniform, all on my first day of working there. And I was like, here I am. I was like, hey, bye. All right, everybody, y'all getting yourselves. Those inmates had to laugh. I mean, even they had to laugh at me. I mean, I'm like, who the fuck is this little girl? I'm like 4'11, 125-130 pounds, just turned 21. Dangerous ass job for me, like for real. Even like before I had started working there, yeah, I had did, you know, security guard at White Lock and Kellow and working a night shift and stuff like that as an unarmed security guard, but this was totally different. Even more so than me being a correctional officer or anything like that, it was just a nervous, unhidden fear of working there. So I think that being a correctional officer is a dangerous job to me, even more so than being a police officer, if you ask me, in my opinion, because you are constantly surrounded by, you know, inmates or people that have been convicted of crimes. At least if as a police officer, you can mingle around and not everybody has been convicted of a major crime. But growing up in Martinsburg, West Virginia, correctional officer Jeffrey Allen Roten, he had been an active and an exuberant kid who loved playing sports. He liked playing football. He liked wrestling because he was a big kid. Jeffrey's father had died when Jeffrey was 7 years old, and Jeffrey grew to become exceptionally close to his mother. Jeffrey grew up to become a correctional officer, and he landed positions with the Florida Department of Corrections and the West Virginia Department of Corrections before getting a position at the medium security Roxbury Correctional Institute in Hagerstown, which is less than an hour drive from West Virginia. Jeffrey had 5 kids who he was devoted to, 4 daughters and 1 son, all ranging from the ages of 7 to 13, and Jeffrey specifically chose to work the night shift at the prison so he could see his kids off to school in the mornings and be there for them when they came home from school. Like I told y'all, Jeffrey was a big dude, and because he was over 400 pounds, Jeffrey's co-workers affectionately named him Shrek. Jeffrey had been working at the Roxbury Correctional Institute for about 4 years, and Jeffrey was one of those COs that you would call to help train new COs. Jeffrey loved his job, but he loved his family more, even though all of Jeffrey's co-workers said that Jeffrey was usually the man or the correctional officer that you would call if you needed help or if you needed a CO to fill in like a shift if somebody called out or they were late. Jeffrey was usually the one that they would call to fill in. And on the night of January the 26th, 2006, 44-year-old Jeffrey was called into work on his day off for some overtime. On this particular night, Jeffrey was assigned hospital duty to guard an inmate who was getting treatment at Washington County Hospital in Hagerstown. 20-year-old Brandon Trayvon Morris had been serving a 7-year prison sentence at Roxbury Correctional Institution for an armed robbery conviction and an assault conviction. A few days before Brandon was sent to Washington County Hospital for treatment, Brandon had jabbed a sewing needle so deep in his stomach that the needle had pierced his liver. Brandon had told the doctors at the hospital that he had gotten hurt at the prison when somebody else had bumped into him that same day, and he had refused to let the prison nurse examine him. But when Brandon got to Washington County Hospital, right away, the doctor could tell that Brandon's wound wasn't like some new injury, because it had already started healing up. The needle that Brandon had jabbed in his side wouldn't show up on regular x-rays, and after Brandon was admitted to the hospital, and an emergency room doctor gave Brandon, like, emergency surgery to remove the needle, Brandon was kept at the hospital for overnight observation to make sure that there were no complications. After surgery, Brandon was being transferred to room 5006 up on the fifth floor. At first, Brandon was being guarded by another correctional officer because shifts hadn't changed yet. But even then, Brandon had asked the officer who was guarding him. He started asking him, like, when is the shifts going to change? And who was going to be the guard that was going to be responsible for guarding him? He kept asking these weird ass questions, and Brandon kept asking to go to the bathroom several times. And this correctional officer would unlock Brandon's leg shackles from the hospital bed, and he would go with Brandon every single time Brandon asked to go to the bathroom. The Department of Corrections policy is to have inmates shackled to their bed while they are in the hospital, and the leg restraints can be taken off if the inmate needs to use the bathroom or if the doctor needs the shackles to be taken off for any medical reason at all. At one time, around 10:30 a.m., according to public records, Brandon asked the CO could he go to the bathroom again, and the CO was like no, because the shifts was about to change. So around 10:45 p.m., Jeffrey came into the hospital to relieve the other officer, so the other officer could go home or get off. The other CO did tell Jeffrey that Brandon had been complaining about feeling nauseous and kept asking to go to the bathroom. And while Jeffrey waited with Brandon to be assigned his private room, Brandon complained about he felt like he was going to throw up. Brandon also kept asking Jeffrey if he could go to the bathroom. A little later, Brandon was finally issued a private room. A registered nurse had been assigned to Brandon as well, and a little after midnight, when the nurse was making her rounds and giving Brandon his prescribed medications, she saw Brandon getting in his hospital bed without shackles. Jeffrey also noticed this, and when he did, he shackled Brandon back to his bed. Right at the same time, Brandon told the nurse that his bandage had come off, and another nurse came in the room to change it for him. About an hour later, around 2 a.m., a nurse assistant came in Brandon's room to check on Brandon's vital signs. And when she came in Brandon's room and checked his vital signs, everything seemed to be all right when she checked Brandon, who seemed like he was asleep. It seemed like to her he was just sleeping. And she saw the correctional officer, you know, Jeffrey, sitting in a chair. Everything was cool. When she woke Brandon up to check on his vital signs, he just sat up suddenly like he hadn't been sleeping at all, like he was faking. That kind of surprised the nurse a little bit, and Jeffrey calmed Brandon down by telling him, "It's okay, Brandon." Another nurse came in the room, and she noticed that Brandon's IV tube had somehow been disconnected from his arm, and that the tube had been leaking everywhere, and she hooked it back up to Brandon's arm again. At 2:30 a.m., a few hours later, the same nurse went back in Brandon's room because now Brandon's IV arm was his IV alarm was going off again, letting her know that Brandon's IV had been disconnected again. Now, this wasn't just like some regular IV that they put in your arm like you see on TV. Brandy's IV tube had been attached by a lever, a lock, and a screw system that it takes a minute for you to dislodge. And the nurse had made sure that the last time she was in Brandon's room that it had been attached securely and the right way. But here it was again, unhooked. So instead of just rehooking Brandon's back up to the IV tube, she just disconnected the whole machine but still left a catheter in his arm. Then the nurse left the room. About an hour later, at 3:30 a.m., Brandon yelled that his bandage had come off again, and the same nurse came in Brandon's room and saw that Brandon was wide awake and was watching TV. Another different nurse came in Brandon's room to check his bandage again, and about an hour and a half later, after she changed Brandon's bandage, around 5:15 a.m., the nurse who had been tending to another patient in room 5007 across the hall, she heard what sounded like a bed or a chair was banging against a wall, and those noises were coming from Brandon's room. Another nurse who had been in a room under Brandon's room on the fourth floor, she heard the same noises, which sounded like fighting and furniture being moved. The shit ain't sound right, so she ran upstairs to see what was going on. The other nurse on the fifth floor walked over to the room to see what was going on, but she couldn't see nothing because the room's light was off. But she could clearly hear fighting and heavy breathing and some kind of commotion going on. She clearly heard Jeffrey say over and over, "That is enough. Stop that. That's enough." The nurse called into the nurse station, which was right next to Brandon's room, and she called in that a fight was breaking out in room 5006. The nurse slowly opened the door, and when she did, she saw the correctional officer, Jeffrey, lying on his back, kind of leaning on his right arm, and Brandon was kneeling over him. When the nurse opened the door, Jeffrey turned and made eye contact with her for just a minute before he focused back on Brandon and Jeffrey's .38 caliber revolver, which Brandon now had planted to the side of Jeffrey's left temple. The nurse actually heard Brandon say to Jeffrey while looking directly in his eyes, "I'm going to kill you, you motherfucker." The nurse heard Jeffrey begging, "Please don't, please don't." And with absolutely no hesitation at all, Brandon pulled the trigger and took Jeffrey's life right then and right there. When the nurse saw this, she screamed that Jeffrey had been shot. Nurses and doctors who had been running towards the room to see what was going on, now all of a sudden they ran back in the opposite direction after the nurse screamed that he had a gun and for them, you know, to run away from the room. Coincidentally, another CO had been guarding another inmate on the very same floor that Jeffrey had been on, and when he heard the nurse screaming that Jeffrey had been shot, he radioed for the police department for help, and he ran over to room 5006 where Jeffrey was. A woman who had been in the next room, which was room 5007, she had been visiting her daughter who was a patient there. She heard the same noises that the nurse heard, and while she was trying to figure out what was going on and if those noises that she heard were like real gunshots in a hospital, while she was trying to dissect everything that was going on, Brandon busted in her room armed with the correctional officer's gun. Brandon grabbed the woman from behind. He shoved the gun in her face and in her daughter's face, and ordered the woman to give up her keys to her car and her pocketbook. The woman refused to give up anything, even at gunpoint, and Brandon kind of just gave up, kind of pushed and shoved and pulled the woman out of the room and into the hallway. The woman, still holding onto her pocketbook and keys the whole time, managed to somehow break free and run back into her daughter's room. The scene was chaotic, as Brandon now just ran out of the double doors of the hospital with the CO's gun in hand, still dressed in nothing but his hospital gown. A security guard who worked for the hospital saw Brandon race out of the hospital, gun in hand, wearing the hospital gown, run over to a cab that had pulled over in front of the hospital. The cab driver had been waiting for a fare when suddenly he was confronted by Brandon, who waved the gun in his face saying, "Drive, motherfucker, you belong to me or I'll shoot you." So the cab driver put his foot on the gas and took off. With Brandon holding the gun to the cab driver's side, Brandon ordered the cab driver to kick out his money and for him to drive him to Pennsylvania. The cab driver handed $50 and $1 bills over to Brandon and started driving. The Washington Hospital security guard started following the cab in his own patrol car and tried to pull up next to the cab. When Brandon noticed the security guard following them, Brandon told the cab driver to crash or collide with the security guard's car to try to run him off the road. With the security guard and other police officers now following Brandon, Brandon led them on a 40-mile-an-hour car chase up Route 1. Brandon tried to grab the steering wheel of the cab. The cab drifted, and the cab eventually crashed into a concrete barrier on the side of the road near the Pennsylvania state line. The whole time, the cab driver had left his microphone on so that dispatchers and the police would quickly be able to find them. After the cab crashed, Brandon crawled out of the window of the cab and ran into a nearby field, still not ready to give up. He headed back towards Maryland on foot, still holding a gun. Brandon ran off into some woods, and for a minute, the police couldn't find him. But this was January, and shortly after the car crashed and Brandon ran off, he realized it's cold as shit out here. So that same night, Brandon showed up at a trucking terminal wearing only boxer shorts, talking about he just got robbed and if somebody could call him a cab for him. Ain't nobody believe that. I mean, come on. So the terminal employee acted like they was gonna call a cab. Instead, they called the police. When Brandon saw that the cops were coming instead of a cab, he took off running again. But this time, the police surrounded him and ordered him to drop the gun. Instead, Brandon put the gun to his head for a minute in an attempt to take his own life. Brandon put the gun to his head, walked away. Then, because he didn't have the courage to take his own life like he had just shot the correctional officer, he just threw the gun to the ground. The money that he had on him, he threw that in the air and just gave up. He was like, you know what? All right, fuck it. You got me. Charged with 36 crimes, including first-degree felony murder of the correctional officer. He was charged with robbery, escape, fleeing the police, everything that they can think of. Brandon was transferred back to prison and held again to await murder charges this time, and also a kidnapping charge when he briefly took the patient's mom as a hostage. And Brandon was also charged with armed carjacking for taking the cab outside of the hospital. Jeffrey was the third CO to be killed in a line of duty in Maryland, and the first correctional officer to be killed in Maryland since 1984. A medical examiner later determined that Jeffrey had died from a close-range gunshot to his head, as well as severe blunt force injuries to the side of his head. After the correctional officer was killed, Maryland's then governor, Robert Ehrlich, ordered state flags to be flown at half-staff in honor of Jeffrey. Governor Ehrlich was one of many who praised and honored Jeff, calling Jeff a pillar of strength to others and always willing to lend a helping hand to those in need. And the warden at Roxbury Correctional Institute, he commented that Jeffrey was usually the first officer that the day shift officers would see showing up for work. At Jeffrey's funeral at the Church of Jesus, more than 1,000 correctional officers, state troopers, sheriff deputies, and other members of law enforcement from more than 20 agencies from as far as Oregon, Arizona, Delaware, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and West Virginia attended and showed their support for the slain correctional officer. And a scholarship fund for Jeffrey's kids was established at City National Bank in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Because of all the intense publicity surrounding this case, Brandon's lawyers were successfully able to get a change of venue and move his trial to Howard County. Prosecutors made it no secret that they intended to pursue the death penalty for this case. The jury selection was scheduled to begin, and as Brandon's trial started on May 31st, 2007, Brandon decided to take matters in his own hands again by trying to run out of the courtroom, what the courtroom officials caught him before he could fully run off. because of Brandon's fiasco and escape attempt in that Howard County courtroom, the judge issued a postponement and Brandon's trial was rescheduled and set for January 2008. This time, when Brandon went to trial, his lawyer's whole defense was based on focusing on Brandon's hellish, torturous childhood. Shocking to nobody, Brandon was convicted of first-degree murder, kidnapping, armed carjacking, and other related crimes. During Brandon's sentencing hearing, a social worker testified that Brandon was raised in the Barkley and Midway neighborhoods of East Baltimore until he turned about 9 years old. Then the fourth grader moved to a row home at the corner of North Rose and McElderly Street, where Brandon often hung around liquor stores, hanging with adults and begging for spare change from anybody who would give it to him, or spent his time begging for money to take back home to his younger siblings. This social worker described Brandon's childhood as traumatic because as a kid, Brandon suffered from sex abuse by his own mother and an older male combined with severe childhood poverty, a constant lack of food, stretches of being homeless, and the constant unrelenting atmosphere and environment of growing up in the drug-plagued streets of Baltimore City. Then what else was Brandon going to become? What else was he going to do with his life but become a fuck-up? That's what's his lawyer's defense. That is so sad when you really think about it. Just because he grew up in poverty and he had abuse, basically his lawyer was saying in so many words, like, okay, well, what else was he going to be but a criminal? So instead of Brandon being sentenced by the same jury that convicted him, Brandon chose to be sentenced by a judge. And the judge took into consideration Brandon's rough childhood. And instead of sentencing Brandon to death, the judge sentenced Brandon to life plus 295 years. Brandon received a sentence of life plus 295 and a half years. I don't know what that half makes, but 295 and a half years for murdering the correctional officer. Which is kind of like a death sentence because he ain't never getting out. But anyway, later, when Brandon was about 32 years old and he had served about 11 years of his sentence, Brandon realized that prison is a motherfucker and he asked a judge to review his lengthy life sentence. But Brandon's sentence modification, of course, was denied. After Jeffrey was killed, the Department of Corrections at Roxbury decided to change its original policy on how inmates are handled when they have to go to hospital for treatment. Before this whole Brandon fiasco, only one correctional officer was required to watch over an inmate. But after the correctional officer was killed, after Jeffrey was killed, now two correctional officers per inmate are now required to watch over them when the inmates are receiving treatment at a hospital. Now, of course, I remember when this happened. I remember thinking, this idiot is crazy. Like, let it go. You're going to prison. You're not coming home. And then you had the gun to your head. You should have pulled the trigger. Because I noticed that a lot of people that kill other people, and especially ones, like, you know, that are guarding them, or, you know, they're so quick, so trigger happy. He bitched out when it was time to take himself out. When he put the gun to his own head, he couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. So since you could not do that and just save society the trouble of doing it, you will die in prison. Like, come on, that man wasn't even, like, he was just doing his job. And I understand, okay, I don't want to be here, I want to go home, but you should have thought about that before you robbed somebody or before you assaulted somebody. You know, it's just like, I mean, of course I selected this case as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicides because, I remember when it happened. And I feel for any correctional officer. And I believe that Brandon should have got the death penalty for this. You know, if you're a grown man and everything comes back to your childhood, you can't change your childhood. And if you're still trying to Michael Jackson that shit and say you never had a childhood and I never got to grow up and I hated you all, and you're standing there and you're in your 30s and your 40s, you're not going to have a childhood and you're not going to get one. So get over that and move past it. And if you can't get past it, yo, he should have got the death penalty for this. Simply put, I don't care about his rough childhood. You know, why do people think just because if you grew up in a bad neighborhood and you grew up with abusive parents, that don't necessarily mean that you're going to become a criminal? You know what I'm saying? So I don't know why lawyers try to use that as a defense, because you can only get so far with that. They may have saved him from, you know, receiving the death penalty, but a lot of inmates wish they had the death penalty so they don't have to live in prison. That shit is not for certain people who, you know, who have lived prison. I will agree that, you know, prison is a savior to some people, but a life to spend the rest of your life in prison? Hell no. People not, it's deadly. I would rather die than it. And I mean, why do you think some people, you know, they used that defense of they were abused as a child to go out and commit crimes? It's because they know that legally that can be used as a defense mechanism for less time, to mediate your sentence, to quote unquote get off because you have a mental illness because you were abused or whatever. If you were abused as a child, go get help for it. Don't go out and kill a correctional officer, or don't go out and kill somebody and use that as a reason for why you're committing the crimes that you are now as an adult. Nowhere reading in any of these, the research that I did for this, and not one article said that he showed any type of remorse. Not one. He does not have a remorseful bone in his body. You know, he's another inmate that will never come home and should never, and does not deserve to be released. Like, what kind of, when I heard about this, I was like, oh, this dude, he should have just went ahead and just shot himself, because he ain't never coming out. And plus, they treating him like shit in prison too. The other COs are treating him like shit in prison. Trust me. They got their own rules there. They make up their own rules. But yes, of course, I chose this one as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicides, because I remember when it happened. I remember when this happened in Roxbury. I remember thinking, oh my God, they're going to be on lockdown for days after this one. But of course, this made the list as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicides, was the murder of correctional officer Jeffrey Rutan. Now, moving right on into this episode's unsolved homicide, but before I do, let me say that this is a podcast that does focus on high-profile homicides occurring in the state of Maryland, and I do realize that a lot of attention and focus is placed on homicides that may have received a lot of attention, they may have received a lot of press and a lot of notoriety. On the flip side, this podcast has a huge major goal in assisting with any lesser known homicides occurring in the state that did not receive the level of press or media coverage that they deserved. It's like one minute the victim was here and the next minute they were not here. And it's a shame that the friends and family of the victim is left to just pick up where they left off and expected to just move on with their life like nothing happened. I remember when my father was killed, it literally felt like the world stopped. And I remember thinking, like, the next day and the day after that, like, how can people just go on knowing that this has happened? But literally, the world just goes on and people expect you to just pick up with your life like nothing happened and just go on living with huge gaping holes in your heart. This portion of this podcast, it shines a light on those forgotten homicides, and it gives a voice to the voiceless and what is now silent. And this episode's unsolved homicide is the shooting murder of 28-year-old Xavier John Arthur Green. According to crimegrade.org, in the town of Glen Burnie, you have about a 1 in 13 chance of becoming a victim of violent crime in Glen Burnie. And on November 18th, 2019, 28-year-old Xavier John Arthur Green became one of those victims. Around 6 p.m., the Anne Arundel County Police responded to the 300 block of Morris Hill Avenue in Glen Burnie for reports of a man shot. And once they got there, they found Xavier shot multiple times. The officers performed CPR on Xavier, and when paramedics showed up, they took over life-saving measures, but unfortunately, Xavier was declared dead at the scene. Detectives believed that the shooter may have knocked on Xavier's front door, and when Xavier opened it, he was shot several times. Several witnesses described the shooter as a black man wearing a light-colored shirt with dark pants. Xavier was born in Washington, D.C., and after Xavier was killed, his family released a statement saying in these words, "To date, justice has not been served because no one has been willing to identify the person responsible for taking Xavier's life. We know that someone knows the truth and wants to do the right thing, and we are praying with expectancy that you will come forward. Our request is not just for our family, but for our community and communities throughout the state of Maryland experiencing the same ongoing, unnecessary, unbearing devastation. Because, as we see it, it never stops here. Look at all the innocent babies, children going to and coming from school, unassuming adults, some pillars in our communities who have lost their lives, murdered in recent years. People are dying at record numbers. While we're all just justifiably fearful, the silence is not protecting our families. Violent crime is getting worse. It's destroying our communities and holding us hostage. Silence has not protected us. It isn't working. Please consider this as you ponder the choice. We thank you in advance. God bless you." In other words, somebody speak the fuck up. Somebody knows what happened. How can y'all do the right thing, clear your conscience? You could even do it anonymously. You know, if you have any information you want to provide for this unsolved homicide, please call Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. That's 1-866-756-2587 on your numeric keypad. You can also call the Anne Arundel County Homicide Unit at 410-222-4731 or the Anne Arundel County Police Tip Line at 410-222-4700. Once again, those numbers are, you can call Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. That number is on your numeric keypad is 1-866-756-2587. You can also call the Anne Arundel County Homicide Unit at 410-222-4731 or the Anne Arundel County Police Tip Line at 410-222-4700. For this particular homicide, there is a reward of up to $20,000 for any information that will lead to an arrest or conviction. Thank you for tuning in this week. Before I go into my usual routine of how you can access prior episodes, let me mention that if you tuned into me at all the last few seasons, I told my listeners that I was producing a true crime documentary that was based off of my very first episode. And that episode, which profiled accused child killers Adon Canella and Policarpio Espinoza. And yep, the documentary is now currently available. Because of the extreme graphic nature of the documentary involving the brutal and horrific beheading murders of three innocent children, networks, they kind of shied away from me. They told me that the documentary was too graphic, it was too much for TV, and all this other stuff. And I guess because the documentary, it does include the actual crime scene photos. I don't water down stuff. Everything is not sugar coated. I refuse to pull these photos from the documentary because the brutal nature of the crime scene photos, they add to the emphasis of the innocence of Adon Canella and Paula Carpio. In order for to fully emphasize the fact that these two individuals did not commit this horrible, horrific homicide, I had to show what was done to these kids with no sugarcoating, no cut cards. There's no way that the victim's uncle and cousin convicted, or the ones that they're convicted, there's no way they committed these murders. And these were some of the most brutal murders, child murders, that Baltimore has ever seen. Either way, the documentary is available via email only, via a WeTransfer link. I do admit that the documentary is not for everybody's eyes, and this documentary was not produced to make money or to get likes or to get followers, which is another reason why I didn't choose the regular typical network route. I cannot and I will not be censored, especially when it comes to true crime and facts and about an injustice that I feel is currently going on. So in order to see the documentary, please visit my website at marylandsmostnotoriousmurders.com, and Maryland is spelled MDS, mostnotoriousmurders.com. You can subscribe to the mailing list by leaving your email address, and specifically send me a request that you want to see the documentary. I mean, I've received a lot of subscribers, but I need a specific request. Send me an email that you want to see the documentary, and I will email the video to you within 24 hours. I gotta warn you, though. I'm gonna put the warning out there, so don't be mad at me. The video is very graphic. It's very gruesome. As I said, networks told me no, because if it's violent and extreme graphic content regarding children. But I believe, to be honest, I truly believe that within the state of the world that we're living in, especially with the way, you know, people are going now, I believe, honestly, that nobody, it's the fact that nobody really cares that these two illegal immigrants are locked up, serving life sentences for crimes that they did not commit. People's attitude mainly are like, well, they shouldn't have been over here anyway. You know, nobody really cares. And that's why I produced a documentary to open up people's eyes that have been closed. And while you're at it, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast via Spotify for updates on future spine-tingling, hair-raising, eye-popping episodes. And for paid subscribers, be sure to check out the real, the raw, the uncensored version of why I decided to start a true crime podcast. A lot of people think that I just woke up one day and then out of nowhere, like, I just jumped on a bandwagon and just decided to start a podcast. But nope, there is a real therapeutic message to this true crime world of gore and mayhem. And if you click on the episode entitled Why I Do What I Do, you will understand more about why I'm so weird, why I'm so crazy, why I'm so fascinated with true crime. And while you're at it, while you're at my website, marylandsmostnotoriousmurders.com, be sure to check out any prior episodes that you may have missed with all of the different seasons that we have focused on, like suicide-related murders. We've talked about robbery-related murders, child murders, even sick, twisted, pedophile, or sex-related type of homicides, which that almost took me off for a minute. You can also find links to all of my true crime books that are loosely related to this podcast entitled Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, 1990 through 2008, Maryland's Unsolved Homicides, Volume 1, and I also have a book out called Until I Get Caught, The True Story of a Serial Rapist in Baltimore, which I'm telling you is a book that every woman should read. You can also check me out on season 1 of Payback, which airs for the TV1 network, where I'm discussing my true life crime story. You can also check me out on the Oxygen Network for Black Widow Murders, where I profiled Maryland's female serial killer, Josephine Gray. Or you can check me out on TV One's Justice by Any Means, which I am again profiling my own true crime story. You can check me out or see me on TV One's Fatal Attraction, where I profiled North Carolina child murderer Peter Moses. Or you can also find me hosting Killer Kids for the Element Network, where I profile teen killers Sarah Citroni and Jason DeLong, who were also profiled for the Parasite episodes. Or you can check out my latest article for the Crime Project, where I'm also discussing again what led me to developing and producing a true crime podcast. Last but not least, many of my listeners have been messaging me on how they can donate to this podcast. On my website, MarylandsMostNotoriousMurders.com, there is a donate icon on the website where you can contribute via PayPal, via Anchor, via Ko-fi, or via the Buy Me a Ko-fi icons. You can also just leave me a positive review on my website. That's appreciated too. So thanks so much for all of your constant support throughout all of the years, whether it has been shown to me through buying my books, reading one of my books, reading one of my true crime articles that I used to write for the Baltimore Examiner, leaving positive reviews on Amazon, or on my shows that have been on television, or even just showing support by listening to the end of this podcast. This is something I've been involved in for a long, long time. I'm talking about even before there was social media. I was conducting book signings. I was putting my story out there. I was writing. I used to call it reality writing. And basically meaning publishing books that the only thing that were changed in them were just the names. Everything else was true. I'm talking about the dates, details. My whole life has always been like a novel. And that's why I decided to write about it. But anyway, please, please be sure to tune in to the next episode, where another gruesome, another high-profile homicide occurring in Maryland, it will be discussed, it will be examined, and it will be profiled on Maryland's Most Notorious Murders. And this has been A Savage Life production.